Hello and welcome to this episode of the Beyond podcast. And this is a bit of a special sampler episode of future things that you can hear on the podcast itself, but also for things that exist behind the terrible paywall that we have erected on our Patreon feed. Because there are some things that you can hear early on Patreon, one of which we'll be discussing in a moment. But there are also special things that we keep embargoed, or at least at the moment we keep embargoed, for our wonderful patrons who support the work we do. If you're interested or able to support the work we do, do go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, and join us. You get all of the podcasts early, about 3 months early at the moment, is the general gist. Not possibly for this episode, actually. The gap is actually relatively minor. But increasingly, that's the sort of gap. And depending on what tier you're on, you get all sorts of other options, which you will hear about later on. Something which is coming out but already to our patrons, but will be coming to the podcast at the end of the year, are the merry, conceited jests of George Peel, gentleman, sometimes a student in Oxford. Now, the patrons have already heard our exploring sessions of these jests. In fact, the patrons get to hear an awful lot of exploring sessions on jests. It's a regular thing that we do. We've had the Tarleton's jests. We've had the merry, conceited jest of George Peel, and we are midway through the granddaddy text of that, Rastall's 100 Merry Tales. And that's one of the ongoing things that we have. And we do the exploring sessions, which, I say, are exclusive to Patreon. They won't be released in any foreseeable future on the podcast. But we do those exploring sessions so that we can create nice versions for you to listen to and enjoy at home. And one of the producers of the nice version of the merry conceited jests of George Peel is with me now. Sarah, introduce yourself to the listeners at home.
Hello, I'm Sarah Blake. I'm a writer, director and actor, originally from the UK but based in Germany. And I've been working on and off with Beyond Shakespeare now pretty much since lockdown, sort of all through the pandemic. I was one of the fortunate souls who found my way to the First Look sessions.
Yes, most of those are on YouTube. You may have heard Sarah occasionally on the podcast, but most of the exploring sessions have now ended up on the YouTube channel, with, say, occasional incursions onto the podcast. But I'm generally trying to keep the podcast in the full cast audio adaptation zone, which is sort of what we're looking at now. So this is the merry conceited jest of George Peel, which is a jest book, but it is also to a degree an ongoing narrative. It's a relatively short text. We're releasing it in 14 episodes plus an omnibus in about a year and a half's time. It will finally all be released, and I commissioned Sarah to do a lovely reading of it. And one of the things we've had with reading jest books is trying to find the right text for different voices. So I knew I wanted Sarah to do an audiobook for us, and I've been sort of scrabbling around and going, well, Tarleton's jest, not quite right. I think we need, that needs to be a male voice. Whereas the jests of George Peel have a certain lightness to them. Jest books are not always, it should be pointed out, very funny. They are not also, they don't always age well. Some of George Peel's jests have aged less well than others. But they're mostly acceptable in the way that some of the jests, some of Tarleton's jests and some of the 100 Merry Tales really aren't anything I would present as entertainment. I would just present them as warnings from history. So I'm just going to ask, so Sarah, I presented you with this text. I don't think you were there for the, were you there for the read? You weren't there for the original explorations.
Mm.
I presented you with this text. How did you find it?
It was like having a bucket of cold water sloshed over me. It was like I started reading it and I just thought, what is this? What is this? Because I have actually I've not been there for many of your jest sessions. I've just the way it's worked out with availability and whatnot. And so my knowledge of Jests is fairly limited. I've been there for more of the sort of first looks of the, you know, the longer plays. And I just found it extraordinary because it throws you in. It literally throws you in at the deep end. It's like somebody is just narrating an anecdote in the pub about, you know, someone they know, this ne'er-do-well called George Peel. And they're just telling you this long rigmarole in the pub over a pint. And you've just been thrown into the middle of it and you don't know who any of these people are or what they're doing. And it just starts. And I found it really, really confusing, honestly, but also just fantastic because from the very beginning, you're immediately just plunged into this world of this character who seems to spend his life riding about England, getting drunk and stealing stuff. And occasionally, you know, writing a play or whatever. And he's just, I mean, he's just a ridiculous character. He's larger than life. And it's really interesting what you were saying there about how a lot of the jests are kind of, you know, not exactly entertaining for a modern audience. I mean, there was stuff in this that I thought, wow, okay. You know, me as a woman reading this, I'm like, gosh, this is actually quite, you know, it's quite hard for me sometimes to kind of, you know, embody this character and bring him to life and actually narrate the things that he does, because I'm like, oh my god, he's really he's not just a ne'er-do-well, he's actually a pretty poisonous bloke at times, but he's also really, really funny and just he has this insouciance to him. And I was actually just really grateful to have the chance to narrate it because, again, just, you know, breezing off into sexual politics for a moment, it's actually very, very rare. You know, I'm an audio geek and I love doing audio. It's very, very rare for me to have the chance to narrate something like this because this is the sort of text that would normally always be given to a male performer to narrate. So it was actually a really interesting experience for me to have the opportunity to get into George's head and narrate his exploits.
I mean, it was that question about, you know, what voices suits this, and there was an element of sort of trying to slightly diffuse because George is not as bad as some of the other chaps we meet in Jests. I mean,
I'll take your word for it.
No, trust me. This is a much lighter approach, whereas, you know, Tarleton is so hyper masculine in his Jests, and so when he is bad, he is very, very bad, and it's very aggressive. I don't think George is aggressive in that way. It's more a beta male chauvinist than an alpha male chauvinist.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think we should also point out that, you know, this is in theory the playwright George Peel, of which we have covered on the YouTube channel and to a degree on the podcast. We have dealt with his plays. This is written considerably after his death and has probably next to no connection with any real events. I should just suggest that none of this actually happened to him. I think the closest we can say is that maybe George was a bit of a tearaway as a young lad, and that maybe some of this is vaguely connected with him getting drunk sometimes, and maybe being very slow on, you know, there's stuff about his writing career as well, and some things that do speak to the sort of the acting profession and the world that he's living in, which may be indicative of the world that existed. But that doesn't mean it's literally true. And there, I mean, you were talking at the beginning about how the story you're thrown into the middle of the story because there is a narrative. It is a bit of a jumbled narrative, and it sort of dances around. So you start listening to your reading, and you're straight in there. But there are things that are not necessarily in the right order. We are presenting it in the order as it comes to us. And it's this question of you bringing up before we went into the record, you know, the question of actually, is it in the right order? Or is the lack of order part of that sort of just flow of narrative? Is that just the, it's supposed to be a slightly drunken pub conversation? what are your thoughts on that? Because you've got a few examples, I think.
Yes. I mean, the thing about being an audiobook narrator is that you develop a very in-depth and kind of intimate relationship with the text. You know, you read it through, you read it to yourself, first of all, just like any person would, you know, read a book or a script to themselves. But then when you start to record it, you actually kind of, it's like you dive down under the surface of the text and you start to really kind of develop a relationship with it that you don't have as just a regular reader. I mean, I don't, you know, books that I read just for enjoyment or whatever, if I was to then start recording one of those books, it would alter my relationship with it, because you're getting into the kind of fibers of the story. And what as I was going along, I realized that there are references to things that actually there were like things quite often in parentheses in the jests, which I was like, okay, that's a detail about him. And then I realized later on, when I was getting into the, like, really getting deep into the text, they were actually jokes. They were jokes that I'd completely missed, because in another jest later on, they would come up. You would find out that the one I'm thinking of in particular is this black satin suit that he mentions in jest one. And then in about the ninth story, there's suddenly this whole rigmarole about how he gulls a gentleman and steals a black suit from him. And so then when this black suit appears at the very beginning, you know, and it's just mentioned in passing, oh yes, remember his black satin suit. It's like, oh, okay, yes. That's his black satin suit that he steals in about an hour's time. You know, so
it's the kind of detail that wonders if that is an apocryphal, you know, semi-apocryphal story that was actually from his life. You know, that he wore a distinctive suit, or there was a story about him nicking it, or something that has been elaborated. Or, I mean, it could just be that it's we haven't done enough jests to have done the full etymology of it all. But it's that sort of question of, you know, some stories get recycled over time. And
yeah, I mean, maybe a black satin suit is like a trope that kind of appears, and it's like a shorthand for a joke. Who knows? But maybe he wore one. I'd like to think that he did. But and there's also an amazing, I think my favorite jest in the whole lot of them is this one where he gets his 10-year-old daughter to enact revenge upon a gentleman who has, I won't give any too many spoilers as to what he's done, but he's wanting to enact revenge, so he gets his 10-year-old daughter to go off and enact revenge for him in a really, really funny story. And there's just like, the first story ends with him vowing revenge. And then the narrative just goes off on a complete tangent for another two or three stories. And then all of a sudden it comes back to the revenge that was had by George Peel, you know, upon the gentleman. But that to me doesn't really feel so much like it's out of order. That does feel like it's, yes, if you're telling these stories, you know, to your mates, you know, round a pub table, this is the kind of thing where you start telling a story and then you go off on a tangent. Oh yes, and then he did this, and then he did this, and then you come back to the main narrative. And you know, that's a kind of fairly, you know, solid structure for a sort of rambling shaggy dog story, and I think that's probably what's going on there. But I don't know, it could be that they are out of order. I it's impossible to tell really, but there, when I first plunged into it, it's like, whoa, what is this? It just seemed very, very random. And then the more I dived into it, the more I realized this is actually really quite cleverly constructed. There's less randomness. You know, one thing I love about this is how breezy it is. Mm. You were talking about the narrative tone being really light. It has a breezy quality to it, which really informed the sort of the narrative voices that I chose for performing it. But beneath that breeziness, there's actually a lot of really quite smart, like, narrative structure choices being made by whoever it was who wrote it.
Mm, yes, because I don't think we have any idea who it is, and as for many of these kind of collections, it does feel, it almost feels like there is an expectation that the reader is already in on this, that, you know, because it is towards the latter end. You know, I think the edition we're looking at is 1627. You know, we've had a good 100 years of this kind of text. This is quite a well-established form. There's an awful lot of... They're just churned out left, right and centre, some of which are very good and some of which are very bad. And sometimes in the same volume, they're very good and they're very bad. And some just openly just steal stories from somewhere else and, you know, with almost no adjustment, and crowbar them into a narrative, whereas this actually does feel like a narrative in the sense that most of the stories all sort of fit who George potentially is, or at least this text idea of George. There are some nice little bits of satire to do with healthcare, shall we say. It's an horrific episode on one level.
It is so funny.
It is also funny at the same time. I mean, we're saying it's funny. This is when the audience listen later on and just going, yeah, we're
yeah, we're, who are these people? Yeah, we are psychopaths. But it's...
I mean, there's always that bit of a sort of early modern lens one puts on. And sometimes, as say, Jess books just push that so far that the lens is shattered and you just go, no, we're not going there. I think there's just enough here for me to put this out without too much introduction. You know, just let the context of the podcast do its work. Whereas, I say, with something like some of Tarleton's Jess or some of the 100 Merry Tales that we've so far looked at, I'm going, no, I'm not putting that out as is, without massive signposts around it saying, you know, approach with caution, here be dragons. I could be proved horribly wrong about this point, but we shall see what the audience thinks.
Well, I think the comment that you made earlier about him being a beta male is just really insightful, because he is actually quite malicious on occasions. He's an interesting character because he has this kind of breezy quality to him, and a lot of the stories are sort of just quite sort of, you know, hail fellow well met, and he gets into scrapes and he gets himself out of them, and yes, okay, maybe he does a few naughty things on the way, but he's just basically, you know, trying to get himself out of a hole or whatever. Then occasionally he does get quite malicious/vicious, and it, you know, it did make me uncomfortable as a reader, seeing what he was doing. But then I think the thing about it is like you say, he's not an alpha male, George Peel. This George Peel, he's really not. And so even though he is sometimes quite malicious in his actions, and some of the stories are quite cruel, it's not it doesn't excuse the cruelty, but it's again, it's quite cleverly written, because he's not this powerful figure who's just constantly getting away with stuff and bullying people. He's just this, he treats people quite awfully sometimes, but then he also gets treated quite awfully as well. And so overall, it seems to kind of balance out.
Well, it speaks to the life of a playwright in the sense of never having any money, and the money seems it constantly makes this wry comment about money slips through his fingers. You know, he walked away with this money. It didn't last long. And it's so the narrative voice is constantly, you know, basically saying, "Don't be like George. He gets away with it,
But does he
away with it?" And I mean, that sort of speaks to that kind of jobbing writer's life to a degree, is that actually it was reasonably hard to sustain a writing career. You could have big successes, but the money never lasts. It's not like you have copyright where you're constantly, you know, you sell the thing, it's now somebody else's. And every time you do that, you have to then find the next job and the next job and the next job. And the jobbing playwright struggled. And that may be more about the theatre world of the 1620s than it is necessarily about when Peel was actually writing. So that might be a thing that's coming in there. But I suspect that actually it was always difficult for the jobbing writer to make a living. Opinions vary on this point, I should add. Some people make the point that some are perfectly successful, but we have plenty of stories of playwrights ending up in penury quite often. And so yes, this idea of this playwright living off his wits and to supplement his not necessarily great income, it's not necessarily unreasonable.
No, and it's interesting. I found there were a couple of like domestic details in, because I mean, these are not domesticated stories by any stretch of the imagination. This is a man who rides around on a horse drinking and gulling people. I mean, so, but and it's funny actually, because when I was working out what narrative voice I wanted to use, I actually ended up, in my own head, at least, I mean, you never know quite how it's going to sound in recording, but I ended up sort of referencing stuff from a lot later, sort of like almost like Just William stories, because there's all this sort of, you know, leaving, you know, like he's like a grown up version. He's like a sort of it's like Just William crossed with Nail and I, because he's this sort of, on the one hand, he's quite innocent. He's this like sort of, he's off on escapades, you know, off in a fantasy world, like, you know, having jolly times and drinking and whatnot. But it is actually quite adult. The humour's quite adult as well. But it's sort of this, like I was thinking about like Just William, and I was thinking about P.G. Wodehouse and Three Men in a Boat, sort of, you know, these kind of really breezy escapade stories from kind of much later. But in spite of the fact that it's all a breezy escapade, there's like the occasional moment of domesticity. There's just like a tiny little chink of a window that you see into just kind of life. And at the end of the jest I was talking about, where he gets his daughter to exact his revenge for him, the gentleman in question goes to George's house, and it says he went directly to George Peel's house, where he found his wife plucking of larks, my crying crocodile, this is the daughter, turning of the spit, and George pinned up in a blanket at his translation. And it's just a simple sentence, but it really conjured up for me, like, this is his everyday. This is when he's not on an escapade, when he's not on a breezy escapade. This is his life. You know, he's been paid to do this translation. This is the only work he's got at the time. And he's pinned up in a blanket in the corner of the room, and his wife's plucking larks, and his daughter's, you know, turning the spit to cook the meat, presumably, and he is just like, yeah, presumably it's quite the room, in spite of the fact that the spit's turning, the room's still quite cold, because he's huddled up in a blanket in the corner of the kitchen, like doing his translation of his whatever it is he's been asked to translate, some ancient Greek or whatever. And there's this real, like, just this, it's just this little insight into the domestic reality of of, you know, what it meant to be, you know, a scholar or a playwright or a literary man at that time, you know. Yeah, okay, go off and ride around on your horse and get drunk. But this is real life here. Mm. This is what he's actually doing. And it's actually not that, yeah, it's not that glamorous. And it's not that well paid. And it's just graft. It's just sitting in the corner of the room with a blanket wrapped around you, getting on with the commission that you've been given, because that's the only money you're going to get.
Mm. Yeah. There are so many little stories we could tell, but there's no point telling the stories because that would spoil the stories for the people who want to listen to the stories. It's always the slight problem. So I'm going to say thank you to Sarah for joining me here today. Say goodbye to the wonderful audience at home.
Goodbye.
And now you're going to hear Sarah in a brief excerpt from the upcoming Merry Conceited Jests of George Peel. The next time you hear my voice, it may sound slightly different because the next link will be recorded later.
The Merry Conceited Jests of George Peel, gentlemen, sometimes a student in Oxford, wherein is showed the course of his life, how he lived, a man very well known in the City of London and elsewhere. George, with others of his associates, being merry together at the tavern, having more store of coin than usually they did possess, although they were as regardless of their silver as a garden whore is of her honesty, yet they intended, for a season, to become good husbands, if they knew how to be sparing of that their pockets were then furnished withal. 5 pounds they had amongst them, and a plot must be cast how they might be merry with extraordinary cheer 3 or 4 days, and keep their 5 pounds whole in stock. George Peel was the man must do it or none, and generally they conjured him by their loves, his own credit, and the reputation that went on him, and withal he should have all the furtherance that in them lay. George, as easy as they earnest to be won to such an exploit, consented, and gathered their money together, and gave it all to George, who should be their purse-bearer, and the other 4 should seem as servants to George Peel. And the better to colour it, they should go change their cloaks, the one like the other, so near as they could possible, the which at Beelzebub's brother the broker's they might quickly do. This was soon accomplished, and George was furnished with his black satin suit, and a pair of boots, which were as familiar to his legs as the pillory to a baker's or collier's neck. And he sufficiently possessed his friends with the whole scope of his intent, as, gentle reader, the sequel will show.
And now, dear listener, we move from this early access recording of the Merry Conceited Jests of George Peel, coming to the podcast, to all you wonderful listeners from the end of the year. And we're going to move on now to a Patreon exclusive, the Patreon exclusive only content, which is, in this example, the exploring session for this same text. So we have read all of the Merry Conceited Jests of George Peel as prep work for the full listening experience that Sarah has produced for us. But this is the exploring session. This is exclusive to the patrons. And this is with myself, Liza Graham, and Alex Scott Fairley.
There's an awful lot of points to try and unpack there. I've been making lots of notes as I've been going along. But yeah, is there a confusion as to how many Georges we have in this Georges, or just the way they refer to George as though George is a different person to George who's in the room who's George? I got quite confused with who was George at any given moment of George. There's a lot of Georges.
I just like that the barber's name is Anthony Knitt.
It's nice we also get a reference in passing to Banks's horse. So, Banks's horse was a performing horse that could perform many wonderful tricks, but playing a lute, we suspect, was beyond it. Yeah, Alex, how was that flowing for you? I mean, did you sort of follow where this was wending?
Vaguely. I did use the Edith Evans technique of if you don't quite understand what you're reading, say it as if it's slightly indecent, which sort of works quite well with some of this stuff. Because it's lots of kind of subclauses and jags that it does. The punch that I sort of got, I got to the punchline eventually. It took me a while to get there. And I guess like any sort of, you know, contemporary joke stuff, it's full of contemporary references. Like I wouldn't have known about the performing horse, I have to admit. And it's sort of like, it's trying to catch someone's delivery, isn't it? Because even though these are sort of written things, it would be like reading a Jackie Mason monologue and trying to kind of make sense of that without having that Jackie Mason voice, I guess.
So we are releasing monthly exploring sessions on Jest Books every month. And there is a Patreon archive of all the Tarleton jests, the Peel Merry Conceited jests, and we're currently going through the granddaddy of jest books, 100 Merry Tales by John Rastall. Each month, $1, £1 tier patrons also get a roundup of all our releases, including, in a good month, dozens of our YouTube videos, and that's months before their release date to the public. We're currently running on all our exploring sessions for the YouTube channel. We're currently running about 6 months ahead. So it's a nice perk for the starter tier. Whereas the Jest Book exploring sessions, they're usually from the £3, $3 mark upwards. Additional bonus videos are also released on our monthly roundup for the one tier, the £1 tier, with rehearsals for upcoming projects occasionally included, along with other, additional bonus material. Like this text rehearsal for a mystery play with Alexandra Kataghida.
Okay, so in my capacity as God, I arrive just after the deadly death of dying, what Cain inflicts upon Abel, page 6, middle bottom.
So Cain, yeah. Come forth and answer me.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. We are
Cain.
Cute.
Come forth and answer me. A soil, which means absolve, essentially, but resolve my question right away.
I am going to just double check because it's one of those slightly slippery words. Again, all of them. This is also the problem. This context sometimes radically changes the meaning of exactly the same word.
Yeah.
I don't. Because sometimes it is a bit like a sail, and sometimes it is not. Answer, I've got actually. Answer my question.
Yeah.
So that's the gloss I've got here from Early English Text Society edition. Again, we've stated that I don't always agree with the glosses, but I'm going to make that note in here.
Okay.
So, yeah, answer my question anon right. So it's just, presumably, they've already used the word answer and they want to use the answer. They want,
come
they
forth
want to
and
use
answer
the word
me.
Again.
In the
yeah,
previous
come
line.
Forth and answer me. Answer
word,
my question anon. Yeah.
My question anon right. Thy brother Abel, where is now he had done? And answer me as tight.
Additional exclusive content includes my readings through other literature of the period, including these workings through of the enormously popular book series The Mirror for Magistrates, written in the early years of Elizabeth and expanded constantly through her reign. Here's my musing on a section of the text where the editorial board for the book discuss how to arrange the material that we're actually reading. And there's a fascinating image of Richard II presented as a ghost. Now, that's really interesting. I like that of just going, we couldn't agree on the sources. One said one thing, one said the other, and we're just going to move on. And then one of the company, we don't know who it is, saying there's some really good stuff I want to talk about, but we're not really sure how to do it or whose viewpoint to take it from. So let's just go and imagine Richard himself. So it's interesting. It's a way of sidestepping material you don't know what to do with in this format, but mentioning it in passing so you get a bit of it. I don't know anything about this mask, assassination attempt of Henry. So I'm really quite interested in that, which is a shame because I don't think we're going to get it.
Oh, well, never mind. So we have this image being, again, set up. We have a theatrical, or in our views, you know, a visual image, you know, maybe of Richard in Paul's church, which is a church presumably all these people would know, so it's a good location to work from. Blue, so he's bruised, pale and wan. Blue wound, so bruised, pale, on cold stones, surrounded by people. It's a very violent image. So it gives us a sense of how perhaps this should be performed. So I'm going to take a little sip of coffee, as is my wont, before I read Richard's plaint. Let's see how performing I get. I don't know how performing I'm going to be. It's just 9 o'clock where I am now. I have had my third cup of coffee, so I should be on a level of performiness. So that was past me looking at the Mirror for Magistrates. I'll be taking a break, actually, from the Mirror for Magistrates next year. We have, or will have covered by the end of this year, the first two volumes. And next year, I'll be starting on Robert Greene's Coney Catching Pamphlets. This is all exclusive content. It's only going to be for the patrons. Additional exclusive content are raw recording sessions for upcoming full cast audio adaptations. So we compile all the takes, all the discussion, with only minor edits to protect the innocent. Here's some raw footage from the recording of Lucidus and Dubius with myself and Lysa Graham. The full cast audio adaptation drops next week.
Do that while I'm saying the Latin.
Yes, that's a good idea. Actually, I'll just keep heckling you. Could you do the whole closing speech, but I'll sort of heckle underneath.
Sir, every priest that hath cure, none outtake whatever he be, and... Sir, every priest that hath cure, none outtake whatever he be, and he stand not in open censure, then standeth it thus as I tell thee. And it be proved, Iwis, be he never so cursed a wretch, not open, but all proof. He may assoil by office of the church, and Christ him soileth. Christ him soileth, and not he. Non enim ipse Christum pereorum officium ligat et soluit. Hec lucidarius sive lumen lecorum. Amen.
What I won't include here are all the early access recordings as you hear them on the podcast anyway. So anything that you're hearing on the podcast, the patrons have almost always heard them at least 3 months early in most cases. Occasionally we have a sudden unexpected drop that we're dropping because we've recorded it last minute, usually a discussion episode where it's to match somebody's book release or something. Early access for all our patron feed, that's for our £3, $3 plus patrons tier. And you get to hear all of this wonderful stuff, but much earlier. Next year, I'm hoping to expand our patron content even further, as we're going to play around with live streaming some live shows, assuming that we can manage to get some live shows on the go. These will be online ticketed events, but our patrons will get automatic access to tickets at an as-of-yet-to-be-determined value, for the lower tiers, there will be early access of the recordings after the date, and eventually, of course, it will all end up on the podcast, but much, much later. So I hope to be adding more perks like that to each of the tiers as we go. We're also looking at a certain amount of other merchandise and publishing stuff, which patrons will get early access to or bonus access to that we haven't as of yet quite got going. Thus ends this extended advert for the work we do and the bonus features that our patrons get. Usually there are two bonus drops each week, plus a monthly roundup with links for our YouTube sessions and additional bonus content there. And if you can, I implore you to join us.
Additional bonuses are, of course, every year our patrons get to vote for a production they want to see. And the more of you that there are, the better those shows get, and the more of them we can do. We're barely scratching the surface of what we could do with your support. And we already do quite a lot, actually. It's a minor miracle, really. So, till next week and a more regular style podcast, goodbye.